As my guest on the final At Home With program, I'm very honored, humbled, and a whole variety of words similar to be in the presence of one of the great musicologists of the 20th century, and a man who's also been a conductor, composer, pianist, and he's done everything, Nicholas Slonimsky. Thank you so much for allowing us to come and talk to you.
Well, if I have done everything, then I suppose I would be subject to a criminal penalty.
Indeed.
Because this is sort of too encompassing.
I see. I was intending to mean everything musical.
Oh, everything musical.
But I guess that could cover some criminal things, too.
Yes. Oh, yes. Some kind of music can be a crime, particularly if it's accompanied by some avant-garde actions, such as mutilation.
Yes.
There was a composition performed in Italy which actually involved castration.
Interesting.
Yes, if I can
say
such a word on the air.
How long ago was that?
About 5 years ago.
Hmm.
And
did the performer survive?
Well, the performer survived, but his wife divorced him.
If I could ask you this, your career has been so long and varied. Can you remember what your earliest impression was of classical music?
My earliest impression of classical music was that it was out of tune.
I see.
Because when I was very little, and I began to realize that there was the world of sounds, which to me was just as immediately perceptible as the world of words. And I realized that classical music didn't sound like an ordinary folk song and had too many notes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very much disturbed why there were such contradictions in classical music. But my aunt was a very famous piano teacher. Her name was Isabel Vengerova. She eventually came to America and taught at the Curtis Institute of Music. Among her students were Leonard Bernstein and Samuel Barber and other celebrities. Well, she taught me music ever since I remember myself. And then when I was 6 years old, my mother told me that I was a genius. And that was a great mistake, because I knew that geniuses usually commanded respect and acceptance and money. So I was growing and growing and growing, and the world was still not at my feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to stage a nervous breakdown at the age of 7 and a half to wait for the world to come to worship me. Well, I think your laughter is very inconsiderate, because after all, I was suffering at the age of 7 and a half.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
You've been known for many years as a champion of contemporary music, and I know that you conducted the premieres of many works of Varese and Ives. Why did you feel the need to do that? Was it because there was not very many people bringing those works to light?
Well, that was one reason, but the main reason was to explore new frontiers of music. You see, I was brought up in Russia, and my musical concepts were formed entirely under the influence of Russian folk melodies and the great works of Russian music, which I heard around, and my aunt played them on the piano, and I learned some simple Russian songs first when I was very young. But then when I came to this country, I realized that there was a new world, And it so happened that I met Henry Cowell and Edgar Varèse and Charles Ives and Carl Ruggles and Wallingford Rieger and several composers from Mexico and Cuba and Brazil. And I was struck by another way of treating music. It was just like learning a new language. And our contacts were almost natural. At that time, I was just starting on my conducting career, and I had nothing to show. I had no name. I had no orchestra. That was 50 years ago. And then I realized that I could do something that other conductors either couldn't or wouldn't do, mainly master those extremely complex rhythms and hear what was going on. And I remember that when I met Ives for the first time, and that was fully 50 years ago, and he showed me his score, Three Places in New England, I somehow intuitively realized that I was gazing at a work of genius. And it never happened to me in my life except with that particular score. Nobody would touch it because it was extremely difficult. There was one movement which involved manipulating two different march rhythms at once. Then I developed a system of conducting which is ambidextrous. That is, I conducted one rhythm with my right hand and another rhythm with my left hand. Someone said that my conducting was evangelical because my right hand knew not what my left hand was doing. But this thing fascinated me. And also I was very stubborn, you know, even if, when I was very young, I was stubborn in trying to overcome obstacles. Here is something I said to myself that nobody wanted to touch, and the music was extraordinary and yet very difficult to perform. So I said to myself, well, I've got to get to the bottom of it. And I did. I performed all those works, and I was instrumental also in publishing this particular work of Ives, and also recording works of Ives and Varèse and others for the first time, because no recording company wanted to take it. And of course the irony of it is that Three Places in New England has become an American classic, and that orchestras are only too eager to perform it, and what they perform is in an arrangement that I supervised for publication. That was the last score that Ives wrote in his own handwriting at my request, because it was arranged for a smaller orchestra, because at that time I conducted the Chamber Orchestra of Boston. So it is very curious now to realize that I sort of participated in history. Mm-hmm. It was not my particular merit in it, except that I understood that it was a great work. And it was the same with some works of Varèse, which also were regarded as an abomination, particularly ionization for percussion only. Now, I conducted the first performance, I made the first recording of it, and the score is dedicated to me. And at that time, perhaps I didn't even realize what an honor it was for me to be in this company, mm-hmm. particularly since they were not recognized at all. Mm-hmm. The proof of it was that when a group of friends of Ives tried to arrange a recording of one of his works, I mean, we were automatically rejected. Mm-hmm. university, and finally we picked up an orchestra, and Ives was a rich man. He made a fortune on insurance, strangely enough, life insurance. And so he could sponsor it, and he could finance the performance. I mean, it was a small orchestra, so it wasn't a big deal, but still it was very difficult. And so these recordings were made, and now I had them reissued under the title Historical Premieres. Mm-hmm. And so, as I say, in this respect, I was touched by history. Mm-hmm. And yet, despite the excellent reviews that I had in Germany and in France, where I conducted the greatest orchestras, I was unable to make a career as a conductor. Of course, I can say that it's because I conducted music that nobody wanted to hear at that time, mm-hmm. Including performances at the Hollywood Bowl in 1933. You can just imagine, it's 46 years ago, mm-hmm. 1933. And I was just at the wrong time. Now, of course, those works are being performed like classical mm-hmm. compositions.
Well, those works are classics now, but do you think the plight of the contemporary composer is still much the same as it was back then? I mean, like people who are writing music now. Do you think you still have the same problem?
Well, you see, now I'm in a very curious position because, you see, I don't see any Ives or Varese around. You see, that's my trouble, or Cowles, or Riegers, or Chavez's, or any of that extraordinary constellation. And of course, you could say, well, maybe now that finally time caught up with Ives, Varese, and others, and they were sort of now overwhelmed and overcome, and I, being first at the head of the pile now, seem to be at the bottom of a new pile. But this is not so easy to prove. I, of course, admire modern composers. I no longer conduct, simply because I can't get engagements. Couldn't get engagements for many years, and I turned to writing, as you know. Mm-hmm. But I honor them in my dictionaries and in my various books, and I'm tremendously interested in what they have to do. But it doesn't mean that anybody producing a jumble of cacophonous sounds would automatically be entitled to be a new Ives. Of course, the works of Ives and Schoenberg and Varese and Alban Berg and others were regarded as cacophonous 50 years ago. So here we are in trouble. See, is it cacophony to perform it, noisy composition now, whereas it was not cacophonous 50 years ago? Well, of course, I have my reasons to give preference to Ives and Varese and Cowell mm-hmm. and others, because I can explain technically why they are right. Great. Now, for instance, there is a new fashion of process music. I mean, music that simply takes a chunk and then develops it out of itself.
Like Steve Reich.
Well, I would better name no names.
Okay.
I mean, they are all in my dictionaries, and I give them perfect respect, mm-hmm. and I'm interested in them, I correspond with them, and so forth. But you see, I want something that would be on the direct line from Bach, who was a very complex composer, to Ives, who was also a very complex composer, and to Varese, who was a complex composer. So I cannot be satisfied in giving up all complexity, all diversity of those composers in order to return to the primitive quality of sort of a transcendental meditation in music.